Welcome to ATS Mix.
And I think until you start asking questions, you know, you're just going to buy whatever's offered to you on the 6 o'clock news.
ATS Mix.
This isn't a talk show, it's a freak show.
From AboveTopSecret.com.
But also be skeptical of the people who are out there selling conspiracy theories.
The Internet's most popular conspiracy theory discussion board. ATS Mix. From AboveTopSecret.com.
In the name of Christ, just let us in!
Starts now.
Hi there, and welcome to the ATS Mix. I am Johnny Anonymous.
And I'm Dave Rabbit, y'all.
And we've got something very special planned for y'all. We have a great interview with the last survivor to make it out of the World Trade Centers before they collapsed. And, of course, I'm talking about William Rodriguez. And wasn't he a great guy, Dave?
Oh, man, I tell you, I talked to him several times before we even did the interview, and this guy is just the real deal, John. He really is.
Absolutely. And you know what? I want to just inform all our members and listeners alike. As you are listening to this, you're going to go through a whole gamut of emotions, as Dave and I did. You're going to go from the beginning of where we're joking around with William, and then we proceed to have his account out of his own words. And then we move into other fields of emotion that we experience, and you're going to hear that. And so you may want to have a box of tissues nearby towards the end there, because you're not only going to get upset, but you're going to get pretty damn mad.
Yeah, you really are. And I just want to point out before we summarize and let you listen to it. It's a two-parter, by the way. The thing is just there was just too much stuff that was just no way we were going to edit out. But there is a section in the interview that you will know when you hit it that there's a gap. And it's not something that is a goof on any editorial part. It's just because there was an emotional gamut, if you will, between Johnny, myself, and William. And because of the emotions involved in what we were discussing, there's a period of time there that there's dead air space.
Yeah, it caught us all off guard.
Yeah, we left that in there because we felt like it was important. Johnny said it best that, some of the best radio is when you have moments like that, and you can't get those any other way than to get the actual human emotion. And we wanted to leave that in there. We thought it was important. But there is a space there that where none of us were able to talk for fear of just breaking down and literally bawling on the air, which we did a little bit.
Yeah, as we tried to do it. This is not the first time we've attempted to do this intro.
No.
We attempted to do the intro right afterwards, and the emotions were so high, Dave and I, neither one could complete it. So this is actually the day after of us doing that, because normally we try to do it right after the interview.
Exactly.
We couldn't keep our composure. We were so overrun with emotions, we couldn't do it the other day. So at least today we feel a little better and feel a little bit more composed.
Yeah, and honestly, John, even last night, yesterday was just such an emotional roller coaster for both of us, as well as William, too. And even last night, it was difficult for me to not think of anything else but the things that we talk about in his interview. And
I'm
telling you, this guy is a first-class hero in my book.
Absolutely, and in my book, too. In fact, that's one of the reasons why we get mad at the very end, and you'll know what I'm talking about when you get there. But anyway, I want to thank our members, all the members and listeners that posted questions for us to ask William. Thank you. Kudos. Great questions. We tried to ask as many as we could that were not already covered by William's personal account that he says. So don't get upset if you don't hear us ask your question, because it was probably already covered in his personal account of his experience on that fateful day. And so now, without any further ado, Dave, let's bring on our interview with the last man out, William Rodriguez.
Be prepared for a ride.
ATS Mix. The following is an ATS Mix exclusive.
I think I will record, because I'm going to do a Taco Bell thing. I think that's funny.
Hello?
Taco Bell? we want chalupas, we want three tacos, we want with Jimmy Janga.
chimichanga, chalupa.
Yeah, I got your chimichanga right here, baby.
Yeah, you got it. No, that's a burrito.
Oh, yeah, maybe in your case, bro.
Ouch.
Ooh. Hey, William, what's going on, man? You doing all right?
Oh, man, crazy. Yeah, just dealing with all these invitations here, you know, to travel. Just like crazy.
So it's not like filling out like birthday invitations for one of the kiddos or anything?
No. Going to get an invitation for Sudan. Because the invitation comes from the Minister of Foreign Relations.
Really?
Yeah.
On a given day, William, how many requests do you get to do things?
Oh, you know, it depends. But let's put it this way. Since just to give you an idea, when I did the presentation for C-SPAN, I did a huge mistake. But I mentioned my email on TV, and I got 35,000 emails. It's the power of C-SPAN. 35,000 emails, and I'm still going through more emails that have come out after that. So, you know, I don't have the opportunity to go through all of them yet.
Wow.
And just to give you an idea how difficult it is. And plus, I go all over the world, and of course, I mention the website all over the world, so right. I get emails from all over. Sometimes I don't even understand because they come out with those garbled texts.
I really like the way that you answer your phone, especially when you went along with Johnny's and my Taco Bueno or Taco Bell bit, which I think's funny.
So here we go, sir. And Dave, are you ready, sir?
Yes.
In 3, 2. The ATS Mix is very privileged and honored to have with us right now a very exclusive interview. And let me tell you a little bit about the gentleman that we're going to be interviewing today. His name is William Rodriguez. He's a native of Puerto Rico and a citizen of the United States and a resident of the state of New Jersey. On September 11th, and for approximately 19 years prior thereto, Rodriguez was employed as a maintenance worker at the World Trade Centers in New York. On 9/11, Rodriguez single-handedly rescued 15 people from the World Trade Center, as Mr. Rodriguez was the only person at the site with a master key to the North Tower stairwells. He bravely led firefighters up the stairwells, unlocking doors as he ascended, thereby aiding them in a successful evacuation of unknown hundreds of those who survived. Rodriguez, at great risk of his own life, re-entered the towers 3 times after the first North Tower impact and is believed to be the last person to exit the North Tower alive, surviving the building's collapse by diving beneath a fire truck. After receiving medical attention at the World Trade Center site for his injuries, Rodriguez spent the rest of the 9/11 aiding as a volunteer in the rescue efforts and at the dawn of the following morning was back at Ground Zero, continuing his heroic efforts. The ATS Mix is so honored and proud to have with us the last survivor of the North Tower of the World Trade Center, Mr. William Rodriguez. Hello, William. How are you, sir?
Guys, thank you so much for this opportunity to actually talk to your audience. And, it's incredible that I was able to connect with you so fast because when I saw a thread on a website that was attacking you guys, I said, I have to contact these people right away. And when I went over there and I saw an above top secret, the whole thing about, the investigations that you guys were putting out together and all the links basically related to my story, I said, whoa, I have to connect with you guys. And that's, how we came about. So thank you for the opportunity and let's start this ball running.
Okay. All right. Just so you'll get used to our voices over the next hour or so, William, this is Dave. And
I'm Johnny.
First thing I want to do, William, is again, Johnny's already prefaced it, but I want to personally welcome you to the interview and tell you what it's been for me a great honor and a great lot of fun to talk to you the last several days that you and I have had personal conversations prior to doing this interview, but I want to let everybody know where your website is, and it's www.william911.com. And for those of you that can't spell, it's www.william911.com. And if you go there, you're going to find some amazing things. William's really got a great site. It tells about the events. He's got a little story area, press, a blog. how to contact William if you'd like to talk to him, either through a blog area or email or whatever. And he's got all kinds of marvelous, wonderful things on there, a lot of celebrity photos with people that he's closely been associated with that have been very instrumental in being a friend to William and his causes. I want to know, when you were a kid, William, did you grow up in Puerto Rico?
I did.
So how old were you before when you guys came to the States?
I came here at the age of 20.
Wow, so you were an adult. You were an adult then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And one of the reasons that I came to the United States was that I was looking for, you know, bigger venues to be a magician, but kind of got sidetracked because there were too many magicians in New York already. So all I could get was a job on a nightclub called Muscly Magic in the Village, on the Greenwich Village.
Wow.
And so I needed to basically get something else just to complement the amount of money that I, you know, that New York was requiring at that time. So I took a job at Chemical Bank on Water Street. And while I was there, somebody told me, yeah, there's an availability of a job at the World Trade Center. And I was always looking for that building. I mean, I knew about the World Trade Center since I came to New York. I used to visit New York many times before. And I said, you know, one day I will work there. And little did I know that that was the opportunity. And I got the job as a janitor. So, well, you know, the pay is good. At that time, it was $8.50. No, $8 and a quarter an hour. We're talking about 1982. And it was a good salary. So I said, you know, I'll take it. And, you know, basically that's how I started.
So I'm sorry, Johnny. You were a magician? Is that what you said?
Yeah, I was a magician. real magician. Strangely, things happen in life because little did I know that the training that I had as a magician was what was going to help me later on, because then I had no fear of standing in front of crowds or doing interviews or stuff like that, because I already had experience doing that with my act. So in a way, it was like I was being prepared, strangely, by fate. Because all the tools that I learned, even the misdirection and all that stuff, I learned it through my early years. And little did I know that every single thing helped me afterwards. You know?
Wow.
On that subject, William, this is Johnny here, William. I happened to be doing some research on you, and I came across this really weird little snippet. Did you at one time work with the Amazing Randy?
That is correct. When I was a magician, the younger version, I call it, I did work with Randy in 1979. Not work, it wasn't a job itself. But I was getting paid to infiltrate as a young kid, to infiltrate the psychic camps, you know,
right,
in a trip that we did through Europe, and which was what came out in a book called Fleeing Flam, The Truth About Parapsychology and Other Delusions. So I needed to gather information of, you know, what the other group was doing. So it was kind of tricky because, you know, little did I know, it was, you know, it was a big thing, actually. They were doing, because Randy at that time was offering $10,000 to anybody that could prove that they have psychic powers and stuff like that.
Right.
So I have to basically, you know, watch out what was going on. And that's how I got some of the training to later on investigate my stuff related to 911.
Wow. Did I also read somewhere where now he is actually an opponent of some of the events that have happened at the World Trade Center? Is that also true?
It is true that he actually was asked on his own forum about my connection with him. You know, we haven't seen each other in many, many, many years.
Right.
And he said that, you know, he considered Willie Rodriguez a very good friend, but, you know, I joined the other side. That's why he tried to claim that, you know, I joined the conspiracy side, but that he value my friendship and I value his. But, you know, if we don't agree with something or we have a dissenting point of view, I'm not going to change it because of friendship. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Sure.
But we got totally discouraged. I mean, once I started working at the World Trade Center many years after, I did see him afterwards maybe once, and it was for the investigation that he did against Popoff and W.B. Grant, the so-called TV evangelists. You know, they were really, I mean, they were doing a kind of crazy stuff. And I did meet him on let's see, on an event in Brooklyn where I went in with my janitor clothes, because I was a janitor. The people from the Brooklyn Academy of Music thought that I worked for W.B. Grant, and the people from W.B. Grant thought that I worked for the Academy of Music. So, so I went backstage, and I saw him when he was putting the little, it's like the IV thing that they put on the ear.
Oh, yeah.
The earpiece.
The earpiece, right. Yeah. Because he was going on the audience and saying that God was telling him that people had cancer and that people had these kind of problems. And it was his wife giving the information to him. So, yeah, we saw the whole thing and relay that information. But after that, I didn't see him. Years and years and years passed after that, you know. I did see him once after when Johnny Carson died.
Right.
I saw him after probably 15 years without seeing him. I saw him in New York because he went to do a presentation for, I think was Current Affair. That was the television show at that time. And to talk about the death of Johnny Carson. And I said, listen, Randy, I got to tell you about, you know, the situation about 9/11. But he was too busy and too rushed, so he never gave me the opportunity to talk to him. So we never had the opportunity to, you know, do a face-to-face or a debate about what happened. So he actually believed his thing. I believe mine. So that's all.
All right. Well, listen, the first thing I want to do is, and there's all kinds of personal questions I have, and I know Johnny does too. But can you kind of give me just a snippet of information of when you were in the building, you know, what you heard, so that it'll bring all the listeners kind of up to speed on where we go into this questioning and answer period?
Well, I went to work late. Actually, I was going to take the day off. I called the supervisor because it was a Tuesday. It was a beautiful day. It was clear. And I said, I'm staying home. I'm taking a sick day. And I called my supervisor, whose name is Anthony Saltalamacchia, and I said, Anthony, I'm not going to work. And he went crazy. He said, no way, you got to come to work. What's wrong with you? And the reason that he went crazy was because nobody else wanted to do my routine, my job routine. I tell you why. I was the person in charge of doing 110 floors of stairwells. I have to clean them every day from the top of the building all the way down. And it was humanly impossible if you didn't have the training, which I developed with years, to do those stairwells. So that meant that if I didn't go to work, they have to send somebody else to cover my routine. So nobody wanted to do that. Have you ever done 110 flights of stairs? It's bad. It's really, really bad. Try doing 25. David, your knees will be trembling. And you're a former vet. You know that.
If you go up
the stairwells, your knees will be trembling so much. And the back of your legs will be having spasms that you will need 2 or 3 days to recover. So people didn't want to do my routine. Right. So he begged for me to go to work. And I said, yes, I'll make it. But, you know, I'm going to be late. He said, don't worry, make it to work. So I made it to work at 8:30 in the morning. When I get to my job, I went straight to the basement of the North Tower. The basement, what we had in the basement was the support office for American Building Maintenance, which was the company that I worked for. And you see, we have 6 up levels of basement, basement 1, basement 2, all the way down to basement 6. And but the support floor for our company was there on the basement number 1. So when I went over there and talking to the supervisor, I punched my card to start my job. And we're talking in front of the door when close to 8:46, while we're talking, we hear this boom, an explosion, very loud, very hard, that puts us upwards in the air. And, you know, all the walls cracked, the false ceiling fell on top of us, the sprinkler system got activated, water started spewing everywhere. It was total mayhem. There's people, 14 people in total, screaming in the area. They didn't know what the heck was going on. We didn't know. And it came from below us, from the mechanical room. You see, that's what I speculated at the time. Not that it was the mechanical room, because a lot of people have put words in my mouth. Is what I felt at the time, that it came from that room, because we were right on top of it, you see?
Okay. On the beat level. William? William, yes. Excuse me, just one second. I just want to make sure that I'm clear here with what you've just said. So prior to the airplane hitting, you heard an explosion below you. Is this what you're saying?
That is correct. That is correct. Coming from below me.
William, what floor are you on, or where are you at in the tower when you hear this?
Basement number one.
Okay, and how many basements are there?
Six up levels of basement.
You're in the basement, the top level of the basement.
The top level, yeah, the one that closest to the lobby.
And you hear an explosion beneath you.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay.
And, you know, at that moment, we just started screaming because we didn't know what it was.
Right.
And when we went to verbalize it, I hear this, all the way on the top of the building, which was what I speculated later on, the impact of the plane, because it sounded like a huge impact. The building shake. Remember, the building was designed to oscillate because of the wind factor.
Right, right.
And, but it oscillated so much that you could actually hear the cracking of the walls. It was like,
really?
You know, when you hear a tree cracking?
Right, right.
Just imagine that, multiply that by 1,000 decibels. That's how
wow.
it sounded.
Wow. Hey, William, right. just real quick, one more time. Sorry, and Dave and I are going to be interjecting here quite a bit during your conversations here, so please, our apologies. Between the explosion you heard below you and the time of the explosion that you heard above you, which you assume was the aircraft hitting the building, how much time was there difference?
Close to 7 seconds.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, I used to say in the beginning when I did interviews that it was like 2-3 seconds.
Right.
And the thing is that I at that time, I never had the meeting with the victims that were with me on the basement. And
right.
we did a reenactment, because when you do this kind of stuff, you have to do like a court case.
Sure.
We sat down and I said, well, my story, they said their stories. I said, and they told me, you know, you're wrong. It was like 7 seconds, you know, because we timed it. And we waited because everybody started screaming. And
sure.
then we hear the impact on the top.
Okay,
and
thank you.
Which actually destroyed a lot of the speculation out there, because a lot of people they try to point out that, you know, what I heard on the basement was the sonic boom traveling through the steel all the way to the basement. So how am I going to hear? How am I going to hear an explosion below me before the plane hit on the top? That doesn't make any sense. And then I
right.
hear the explosion all the way on the top. And I'm not the only person that heard that. I mean, I have videos of interviews of other people that did that. But
okay, well, continue on, though.
Hear this, yeah, as you hear this, total mayhem, everybody screaming, you know, because it was total confusion at that moment. A person comes running through the hallway, saying explosion, 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 and he is in shock. He's a guy that is a black guy from Honduras who I never met before. You know, I find out this information afterwards. The guy,
right.
his name was Felipe David, or Felipe David. He was
right.
the person in charge of supplying all the vending machines with supplies, you know, with sodas and candies and so on. His hands extended, David, Johnny, his hands were apart. And when I saw the top of the fingertips, he had something hanging at the fingertips that looked like cloth. And I thought it was clothing. As he got closer, everybody went crazy. I mean, we started screaming in such a horror, because it was his skin that was pulled from under his armpit.
Geez.
Peeled
oh,
off on both arms. Peeled off, totally peeled off. And it was hanging like when you take off a glove. And, you know, the guy is in shock, and I say, don't move, don't move. And then his red shirt was soaked in blood, and so it wasn't red. It was just blood. You know, it was a shirt that was just stained, and that nobody's helping the guy. I said, don't move, because I was going to pick up the phone to call the emergency medical unit that was located on the south tower. You see,
right.
the south tower and the north tower connected through the basement. On a walking distance. So
sure.
I wanted them to, the emergency medical unit to be aware that I have somebody injured, so they will show up. When I went to pick up the phone, and remember, everybody's screaming, I went to
right.
pick up the phone inside the office to call EMS, when we hear, bah! All the way on the top of the building again, it was a huge explosion, and the building shakes so much again, and at that moment, you know, everybody started running inside the office area and started going under the door frames, thinking that it was an earthquake because the floor was moving below us. And people are just piling up and screaming. My supervisor, Anthony Saltanamacchia, is saying, it's a bomb, it's a bomb, it's a bomb. You know, and we're acting by osmosis because we survived the bomb of 1993, you see? And by surviving an event like that, that was, and for those that don't know or don't have the information, in February 27, 1993, a bomb was placed at the World Trade Center on that same basement. So we are basically survivors of the first incident as well. So we acted by osmosis. So everybody's piling up. Nobody's helping Felipe David. Felipe is right there in shock, his skin hanging. And one thing that I also didn't want to mention was when we saw his face, the side of his face was hanging. It got pieces of his face hanging.
Wow.
And, yeah, horrible. And, you know, but nobody wanted to touch him. David, because this was 2001. Remember the whole AIDS scare that
sure.
nobody wanted to touch anybody with blood?
Right.
This was, you know, nobody wanted to help the man. So I looked around and I find a towel. And I put the towel around the guy. I put it on my shoulder. You know, I just, you know, tilted him like that. And I started screaming, we got to get out. We got to get out. And nobody wanted to get out. Nobody wanted to move. So I started pushing everybody out. And basically, you know, led the whole way from the office to the area where they have the stairwells, but they were smoking there. Then we went back to the area where they have the loading dock. We went down. Then we went up to the area that was the main entrance of the loading dock, which was a hill upwards that left outside to the building. And I'm just basically screaming and everybody, you know, following. And up to the moment that we get outside the building, when we get outside the building, I see an ambulance coming. When
right.
I see the ambulance, stop the ambulance, and I put Felipe with the help of the other two guys inside the ambulance. When we do that, the guy goes into a coma. And you know when a person goes to a coma that everybody goes crazy putting adrenaline and stuff like that? And that's
right.
when I hear for the first time, a plane hit the building, a plane hit the building.
Okay, hey, but, William, one quick question here. And again, my apologies for interrupting you.
Go for it. No, go for it.
All right. So we've heard an explosion in the basement. Then we heard another explosion. And then a gentleman came running out, who is Felipe. Then you heard another explosion after that?
Well, there's several explosions on the top.
Okay,
there
so now we've heard
an explosion in the basement, and
right.
then all the other explosions came from the all the way at the top of the building. Could have been the wings of the plane blowing up. It could have been you know, it could have been so many things. But again, we have no way of knowing because we're
gotcha.
Inside the building, and we're all the way in the basement. And number two, we don't have because we were in the basement. We have no windows.
Right,
so
but at this time, you guys have heard.
On.
But at this time, everyone has heard. Three explosions at the time that you're running outside.
Correct, correct.
Okay,
correct.
Please continue.
And then, you know, basically when we get outside the building, that's when I hear, you know, a plane hit the building. But when I looked around next to the ambulance, what I saw was actually a security guard. There was a security guard that led the trucks with deliveries to go inside the building.
Right.
And he's standing there looking up, mouth open, everybody around him doing the same thing, and the actual transmission of the radio was the one saying a plane hit the building, because
right.
nobody else was talking.
Sure.
And everybody's like in shock. So when I turn around and I looked up, what do I see? The hole, I saw the fire, I saw the smoke on the side of the building. Now, because I am at the foundation of the main entrance of the building, I'm close to the building. When you look up, you have this kind of optical illusion because the building looks like a pyramid because
right.
you're looking from the ground up. So I couldn't see the antenna of the building because the smoke was so dense that it went up and it covered the antenna of the North Tower. And the North Tower was the one with the antenna, for those who don't know. And when I don't see the antenna, I realize, oh, my God, the people from Windows, the people from Windows. And I meant the people from Windows of the World. Windows of the World was the restaurant that was located on the 106th floor. Inside this area, you have so many people that I knew. So, of course, automatically I'm reacting. And the reason that I'm saying, we got to go back, we got to start screaming, run away. We got to go back, we got to go back. You see, it was a miracle that I came in late, number one, because
right.
if I got there at 8 o'clock, David, I would have been all the way on the top of the building because I started cleaning from the top down. And I went to Windows of the World every morning because they gave me breakfast for free. And you know, when they give you something for free, you'd be there on time. So when I will go to work, I will spend some time on the employee kitchen, you know, hanging out with these guys. And so I knew that they were in trouble because, you know, the smoke was so heavy going up. I'm not talking about fire, smoke. And sure. I did see fire, though, and debris falling apart. So I started screaming, we got to go back. Nobody wanted to go back. My supervisor said, Willie, you stay here. You're not going back in. And I got so angry, and I said, forget you. Well, the audience will know that that's not exactly what I said.
Another word, right?
But I said, you know, just to clean it up a little, forget you. And I took the radio from the security guard, who I knew, and I started running back inside the building.
Right.
Because I wanted to go to the South Tower. You see, once I get inside the area, I went to the South Tower for the simple reason that I wanted to let the people know from the OCC, which meant the Operation Control Center, after the bomb of 1993, the Port Authority, at a cost of almost $155 million, they retrofitted the building and all the properties of the Port Authority, and they set up this command center way below on the basement of the tower. You know, it wasn't right. That wasn't a smart idea anyway. But this that command center have everything dealing with emergency. I wanted to let them know that I had a person that was injured outside the building. So I went there, and that was supposed to be manned 24/7. And I started hitting the radio, the window, screaming for people to come out, and nobody came out. This, you know, it was empty, and that scared me because, you know, later on I find out there were people there earlier. But where were they at that moment? You know, they couldn't understand it. And a person comes up on the South Tower, remember, up from the subgrades. His name, Jimmy Barrett. And he said, Willie, what's going on? I said, well, didn't you hear? I started screaming back at him. And he didn't know. He didn't understand what was happening for the simple reason that he was all the way below on the South Tower. Think about this. This gives you an indication how many people probably died on the South Tower without ever knowing it because they never got the information. And when I looked around, I'm screaming at him, you know, you got to get out. And I told him about the man that was burned and about the explosion and about what was going on. And when I looked around, what do I see? Between the two buildings on the basement, there was an employee entrance for the Marriott Hotel. There was a Marriott Hotel between both buildings. And there was a lady on a podium, security guard, Latino Hispanic lady, standing there and shaking. And I said, what are you doing here? You got to get out. Get out now. Get out now. And she said, I heard everything, but I cannot leave. I said, why? And she said, because she's a new employee. Listen to this. Because I am a new employee and I don't want to get fired.
Oh, wow.
And this was like so shocking. Johnny, think about this. You know, again, we didn't know. We have no information. Remember, you're watching this on television live. The whole world was watching this from across the world. I mean, from across the country, everywhere. And they have better information than we did inside a building.
Wow.
You're watching this real time. And so I scream and, you know, push that lady out of the building and go into the North Tower. When I get to the North Tower, I find a recycling guy who screams, you know, I hear screams. But there was so much water because of the sprinkler system. And that's another indication. Remember, the sprinkler system got activated on the basement. If the plane hit the tower, why would I have the sprinkler system on the basement? So there's water everywhere, and you couldn't hear anything. And each building have over 100 elevators, you know. And
sure.
I put my ear in one of the elevators, a freight elevator called the K7 car. And what do I hear? Two people screaming, help, help, help. And it was horror. I mean, it was like the most horrific job for help I ever heard in my life. The first thing I said, how many of you in there? They answer back, there's two people in here. And something that marked me forever, they said, we're going to drown. And I couldn't understand because why would these people be drowning? And, you know, of course, what it is that there was an explosion below us. These people went inside the elevator to protect themselves and the door closed. And instead of going up, it went down. They lost power. and they got encapsulated and stuck between two sub-levels of basement, between the B2 level and the B3 level.
Wow.
And all the water from the sprinkler system was rushing through the elevator shaft. Now, I didn't know what to do. And the first thing is I said, oh, my God, help me, help me. And I started looking around, and I found a metal pipe in an area that was supposed to be totally clean of construction debris. Picked up that pipe, and with the help of the other guy from the recycling, we opened the door. We pried it open. And when I looked down, you know, the elevator shaft is empty because the elevator is way down. And when I looked down, what do I see? These two people looking up in horror with water up to their bellies. And I started screaming, you know, because I didn't know what to do. And the reason that I was able to see them is simple, because it was a freight elevator. And, you know, it doesn't have a roof like a regular elevator. It has like a metal mesh, and you can see right through. It's like a cage. And the water was going in with such a force, but it wasn't coming out at the same rate. And I said, oh, my God, help me again. And I'm like, you know, totally crazy trying to find out a way to help these people. And I remember that in the area where they have the garbage compactors for the building, between the two buildings, the electricians always have ladders that they put there and tie them up next to a wall, you know, like a pillar, so nobody will steal them. They will chain them and lock them. I found the only one that was not chained was the longest one of all of them. So I picked it up, went back, dropped it inside the elevator shaft, went in with the help of the other guys, and opened the grid. I'm getting radio calls from my company. Where are you? What are you doing? You can actually get the actual transcripts from the fire department, where you hear me saying, you know, well, I cannot leave, because they're saying abandon the building. So I cannot leave the building because I have people stuck in the elevator. We try to get them out. Basically, when I opened the grid, I was able to pull these two people. One of them was Salvatore Giambanco, a painter for the Port Authority, who I, again, did not met this guy before, did not know him. And the other one was a delivery guy. Pulled them out, you know, with the help of the other guy, got them outside the building, put them in an ambulance. I started running again to the building while everybody was screaming, don't go back, don't go back. And that's when I said that I made myself the stupid one. I started talking in Spanish, so, you know, because I didn't want to be stopped. I said, no, yo no tengo que parar aquí, yo tengo que buscar a mi amigo. And they were like, what the heck is he saying, you know? But it just, by the reaction, you know what I'm saying?
Sure, yeah.
And I'm running back, running back. And when I get there, who did I find there? The only person that I find there is a Port Authority police officer in charge of the canine unit, the dogs that smell for bombs and drugs. His name is David Lim. And he said, Willie, do you have the key? And he meant, did I have the master key? And I said, yes, I have the key. And the reason, again, that the key was so important was that there were five master keys available, and the people with the other four master keys were the Port Authority operation managers, trained on egress, escape, rescue, and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
And I had the other one, and little did I know that that key was going to be so crucial. And again, the key was so important because the World Trade Center was a Class A building, and a lot of people tried to...
Now, what does that mean, Class A building? What does that mean?
Class A building on the building codification of the state of New York established that a building over 50 floors and above need to have an encapsulation system on the stairwell for fire, meaning that, you know, if there's a fire... You know, if there's something called a backdraft, that if there's a fire, the people on the top will tend to go down and open the first door to try to escape.
And
when they do that, the fire will come out as a ball of huge flames, and basically because it's looking for oxygen, and will basically devour the building in a matter of hours, basically.
Right.
So they needed to have that contained. That meant that three doors will not open on the stairwells to have access to the offices, and then one door will open. Then again, three doors will not open, meaning three floors. As you went up, they will not open. They were locked. And then one will open all the way to the 110th floor. So meaning that every fourth floor, the door will open. So you see, the reason that the key was important was that if I take you back to the bomb of 1993, a lot of the time was spent by the firemen breaking the doors open. These were steel doors. They had to pry them open with these huge hooks that they use.
Right.
But that takes time, you know, seconds or whatever, but it takes time. And that's one of the reasons that we have over 1,000 injuries on the bomb of 93, because, you know, well, the injuries were done, but, you know, the help for them was a little slow because of that reason. So I started going up. I said, yes, I have the key. Let's go up. We made it to the lobby. When I made it to the lobby with David Lim, the fire department was there, and they're waiting with something called the fire access key, which is a key that they will put on any elevator, and if the elevator is up, we'll go down to pick them up. If it's down, we'll come up. And they're waiting there. I said, forget about the elevator. And the police officer said, don't wait for the elevator. Follow him. He knows the best way to go up the building. He knows the building very well. And he has a master key. Follow him. And this whole unit of firemen, of heroes, my heroes, started to follow me as I went up and I started opening doors. But it was a sad memory for the simple reason that as we went up, listen, imagine these guys with over between 50 and 125 pounds of equipment in their bags.
Right,
that's
right.
A lot of equipment. On top of that, you know, below that, they have these fireproof uniform with the helmet, with the right. boots and whatever. So as we went up, the stairwells were not wide enough. So the people coming down kept bumping onto us, making our ascents very difficult, really
sure.
difficult. So as we went up, we realized that, you know, I said, we got to change, and we got to go by the other stairwell. There were three stairwells on the World Trade Center, stairwell A, B, and C. So we started by the B staircase, and we changed by the A staircase, which faced the area that was hit by the plane. And as we went up, I started opening doors and screaming for people to follow my voice. The firemen will go in, we'll check, because that key opened everything. We'll check of offices that were locked or things like that. And basically screaming for people to come out. And one thing that usually we don't talk about, and I don't like to say it, but, you know, since somebody else mentioned it, or one of the firemen on one of the interviews mentioned it, I'll say it, you know, there were people that found that it was more important to wait for the facts than to evacuate the building. And that is the truth when it comes to an emergency. There were people that wouldn't leave because they were expecting an important fax. And we got to, like, you know,
you're kidding
them
me.
Outside, basically.
You're kidding me. They're standing there waiting for a stupid fax,
even though
they've been told, get out of the building.
Correct.
So these people probably died because they waited on a fax.
Well, the ones that we saw, we basically kicked them out. Not kicked them out, but, you know, we said, no, you got to get out now. And they have to, I mean, with the firemen there.
Okay, so they did follow your instructions. They just were.
Well, we don't know on the upper floors what happened to those other people.
Okay,
but,
sure.
You know, you have to take our presence for them to leave in a way. And basically just give you another idea, you know, how many people found that it was more important to wait for something, an email or whatever. And that is sad.
But you know, I'm going to do a really short sidebar here because I want you to keep with your flow, William. But, you know, to me, it makes sense to me in a way, in a crazy way, because that's the way it was in Vietnam. You know, when I was in Vietnam and we had rocket and mortar attacks, well, the very first time you get really scared and whatever, and you start panicking and whatever, and then it becomes, well, we're not going to really worry about mentality. Well, since the 93 bombing, they already knew that worked out okay. So, you know, and I'm not defending these knuckleheads for sitting there waiting on the facts, but still, you know, maybe their mentality was that they didn't know it was. And this gets back to what you said about how the people at home, the people at their offices, whatever, are watching it play out on national television, and the people themselves that are in the building don't have a clue. And that's probably what they were doing. You know, they were thinking, you know, it's probably like the 93 bombing, whatever. Do you think that or not?
Correct. You're correct.
I have a quick question too, William, before you continue
on.
How much time has actually passed now from the time of you hearing that first explosion in the basement?
No idea. You know why? Because you don't look at the watch at all when it's an emergency like that.
Sure.
I always say, a second could be a minute or it could be an hour.
Right.
It's like, you know, when I was under the rubble, people ask me, how long do you feel that you stayed under the rubble? And I say, well, it looks like it was a century for me, because you lose total sense of time.
Right.
Okay,
yeah.
I appreciate your honesty.
Yeah, your adrenaline start pumping up. You're trying to get the most amount of people out in the least amount of time.
Right.
And I don't remember through the whole ordeal that I look at my watch a single time. Okay, we're opening doors, letting people out, screaming in certain areas for people to follow our voices. The firemen, those heroes, will go in as a unit because, you know, they're trying to work as a team.
Right.
They will work in and they will check areas. If there was a body, and there were bodies, I tell you why, because some glasses will, you know, burst on the windows and people will have desks on those areas. You know what I'm saying? So they go in and basically they put marks on the walls with the spray that they have and, you know, basically that the area was checked or things like that. And we continue until the moment that I found myself sometimes two and three floors above them opening doors because they were not keeping at the same rate as I was going up. But remember, they're working as a team.
Right.
I was basically, my job was opening doors and screaming. That's what I did. But then I find myself sometimes two and three floors, and I hear these three explosions on the lower level. I hear pa, pa, pa coming from the area. It's called the third zone. The building was divided in three zones, from the 110 all the way to the 78th floor, from the 78th floor to the 44th floor, and from the 44th floor to the first floor. So, of course, when I hear this, I go down and I ask the fireman, what was that? What was that? And they told me it must be the gas tanks blowing up in the office kitchens, in the pantries, you know? And
right.
I was, what? Yeah, it must be the gas tanks blowing up in the kitchens. And I said, you know, to myself at that moment, I said, that didn't make any sense to me because all the kitchens were electrical.
Right.
You know, there's something called hazmat guidelines on a skyscraper, meaning that, you know, if you have a skyscraper, you're not gonna be allowed to have this kind of stuff. And
right.
Everybody in construction will tell you about that.
For safety reasons.
That didn't make sense to me at all. So I said, well, okay, gas tanks. And I continued, but I didn't understand, and I never found out what was those explosions. And as I continue opening doors and going up, somebody said, there's a man on a wheelchair. There's two guys coming down. One of them tell me, there's a man on a wheelchair on the 27th floor that cannot breathe. He's having difficulty breathing. He's asthma or something. I went down. I told the fireman, there's a man on a wheelchair. What do we do? I said, I don't know how to help this guy. So they said, don't worry, we'll make it up there. So we basically made it to the 27th floor. When I opened that door, my friends, the most shocking thing for me was that whole unit of firemen, they went in and they started to collapse on the corridor one by one by one because they couldn't continue. They have no more stamina, no more strength. 27th floor with all that equipment, you know, basically using their force to go into areas. You know, it took all their strength. And they started on the corridor. They took the equipment. They dropped it on the floor. Some of them took their jackets. Some of them took their boots off, and they sat there. And I did see the man on the wheelchair. His name was Ed Bayet, a quadriplegic. And he's there. You know, some people started to give him first aid. They took him out of the wheelchair and put him on a rescue basket. You know those baskets when you see a helicopter?
Right.
They put him in there, and they tie him up. And, of course, when I see these guys on the floor, I say, oh, my God, what's going on here? Police officer David Lim said, Willie, do you know this floor? And I said, yes. He said, where can I get water? I said, well, on the opposite side of the floor, there's vending machines with the bottled water. I said, let's go. And I said, oh, my God, I have no money. I'm looking on my pockets for change.
Right.
And I'm like, and we made it in front of the machine, and I'm still looking for money. And Lim looks at the machine, and he breaks the machine. He just uses his foot and breaks the glass and his stick and then just breaking the glass and he starts taking the bottle water. I'm like, oh, my God, I'm getting out of here. You know, because I'm like, this guy is breaking the law. He's a cop. And
right.
I'm like, uh-oh. And I said, you know, I'm the Puerto Rican here. They're going to blame me. So I'm getting out of here.
Yeah, I got the Puerto Rican.
So, so I didn't want to be blamed. But David said, you know, get trash cans. And I start getting trash cans, and I start filling them up with bottled water. And we took that bottled water, and we just, you know, distributed it to all the firemen that were, you know, on the floor.
Sure.
And that's when I look to the left side and I see a guy using the phone. And I say, oh, wow, there's a phone service. Let me call my mother to let her know that I'm okay. And my mother is in Puerto Rico. So I wanted to let her know because in case she saw something on the news. Oh, but then again, right. What a surprise. Remember, everybody was watching this all over the world.
Sure.
And when she picked up the phone, she was hysterical. Where are you? What are you doing? And I said, Mom, I'm in the building. And she just went crazy because she's watching this on CNN in Spanish.
Right.
And she's like, get abandon the building. Get out of there. You know, get, what are you doing? Get out, get out, get out. The building is on fire. And I said, Ma, don't worry. I'm okay. Nothing is missing, meaning that, you know, I wasn't wounded or anything. And I have the master key. And these people, in my ignorance, talking about the fireman, and these people don't know the building. They were totally disoriented. So
right.
I said, don't worry. I will help them, and I will call you later. And she was like, don't go to the fire. Don't go to the fire. And I lied to my mother because I said I wasn't going to go to the fire. But the crazy thing is I would have gone through that fire 100 times just to get to my friends. And I
sure.
just like said, don't worry, I will call you later. And I hang up the phone, and at the same time I'm getting calls from my supervisors across the street from the building, William Rodriguez, location, location, location. I'm telling them that I'm on the 27th floor, that, you know, they're helping somebody here, helping the firemen, I have the master key, and they're like basically, you know, to leave the building. And I just like, no, 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 I'm helping these people. And I shut off the radio because I didn't want to be bothered by them.
Right.
And continue going up by myself because remember they're on the corridor, collapse on the floor. So I
right.
continue opening doors and going all the way to the top. When I get to the 33rd floor, I open the door, I go around the corridor, everything was empty, and I found a lady shaking on the floor, no shoes, trembling, American lady, blonde, and I start screaming, get out, get out, what are you doing, get out. And she said to me something that actually, you know, also changed my life. She said, you know, that she's a new employee in the building and she didn't know where the exits were. Not that it wasn't difficult to find them, but, you know, she didn't know. And that gives you also some of the fights that we did after 9/11, because a building like that, a city within a city, did not have guidelines for training. In other words, they did fire drills only twice a year. And now we do have over 50,000 workers on a complex that big. You know, mathematically, the amount of people getting hired, getting fired, retiring
right.
is a constant. It never changes. They should have mandatory training for people to work in that building once they started to work to know exactly where the exits were. She didn't know.
Sure.
And I basically grabbed her, picked her up, you know, pulled her up, and pushed her to the stairwell. And luckily, there were two guys coming from the 43rd floor cafeteria. They have all this white dress, white uniform on it. And I said, guys, I need help. He said, Willie, what do you need? What's going on? He said, I need you to help me get this lady out of the building. I said, we'll help
right.
you. And they start bringing her down. And then I went back to the 33rd floor. And I always say the 33rd floor was a very important floor for me because it's where I had my office, which was actually a closet. But, you know, it's what I call an office because that's where I had all my supplies for cleaning the stairwells. And I'm there looking for a box of paper dust mask to give to the people so they would not smell the acrid smoke that was in certain areas. And when I go there, what do I hear? On the 34th floor, I hear this sound moving around of heavy equipment, and it scared me because I knew that the 34th floor was empty because the people that were there, the tenant, moved out a long time ago, and they sent a demolition crew to basically demolish the walls and everything. You know, when you're in a building and a tenant moves out, that's how they make money. You know, the building will make money by sending a demo crew. They will demolish everything, and then they will rebuild it to the new specification of the new tenant, and that, they will charge money for that. That's a standard practice.
Right.
So I knew it was an empty floor, and for me to hear that heavy equipment, it scared me. So I bypassed that floor, and as a matter of fact, it was the only door that I did not open on 9/11 as I went up, and I never find out what was that sound.
Wow.
And I continue up and up to the moment that I get to the 39th floor. When I get to the 39th floor, David Lynn comes with two fire chiefs. They have these white shirts, you know. Do you know the difference between a regular fireman and the chief ones?
Right.
And sure. we're talking about what was going to be the next step when we hear this, boom, this huge explosion coming from the other building, from across
wow.
us. I don't know. I used to believe at that moment, I believe that is, you know, when I'm trying to recreate the whole thing, that is the plane hitting the other tower. Uh-huh. Not that it was, because a lot of people think that that's what I'm saying. Not that it was, but it was an explosion so loud that our building shake. It created a sound wave that made our building shake. And then on our building, we hear, pa, 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 pa. And on the radio, we hear, we lost 65. And David Lim said, you know, basically that the 65th floor collapsed floor by floor up to the 44th floor, the sky lobby, five flights away on the top. And, of course, it was so loud, it was so powerful, we were actually lost our balance. And I went crazy. I started screaming, we got to go up, my friends, because now I'm really desperate. Now I really know these people are stuck in there. They really need our help. And at that moment, David Lim said, Willie, you've done enough, but you don't get paid for this. Get out. I say, David, I don't care. I'm going up. And he said, no. You're still a civilian. And you are my responsibility. Do me a favor and get out. And I didn't want to stop. I said, no, I'm going up. You're not going to stop me, basically. And what he said was something that really made me think. He said, better if you give me a hand with a man on the wheelchair on the 27th floor and get out. And I kind of got angry. And I said, you know what? I will help you with this guy. I will get him out. But I'm coming right back because I am not giving my key to anybody, meaning the master key, because they told me if I lost the master key, I will be automatically fired, you see?
Right.
And there will be an investigation against me, and I will have to pay for the changing of every single lock in there. So I said, no, I'm going to hold that for my dear life. But it was only David and two firemen with me and the two fire chiefs who didn't even know who I was at that moment. And I said, don't worry, I'll help you with that guy. And I ran down to the 27th floor. And I scream, you know, I have orders by the Port Authority police to get this guy out right now, meaning the Ed Bayer, the quadriplegic. He was already on the rescue basket. So as tired as they were, and this is how you know how big heroes they were, one of them stood up and said, we'll help you, buddy. And they made a signal, let's go, guy. And two other guys stood up, and we picked him up, and we started going down the stairwell. We were followed by a couple of people. As we go down, you know, I realized something, and you as, talking about David, as a survivor, basically, from the Vietnam War, you understand this,
oh, of course,
and you will relate to something about what is post-traumatic shock disorder, and shock
syndrome,
disorder
right.
at the moment, is that as I went down, I realized that I heard something that I didn't hear as I went up, because when you're in a battlefield, you try to shut off sounds that are very traumatic
exactly.
for you.
Right.
And as I went down, I heard the screams of the people screaming for help stuck inside the passenger elevators, and I realized that as I went up, I shut them out because I didn't know how to deal with it.
Right,
and as I
right.
went down, I heard them, and I looked back and I saw the face of the fireman just moving his shaking his head, like saying no, you know, like we couldn't do anything kind of action. And right. As I go down, I hear this huge boom again, and it was so loud that the building shake so much we lost our footing. And the fluorescent lights, you know, the long ones, the
right,
phosphorescent
right.
lights, because the building shifted position, the actual holders on each end of the light will change position. You will hear them blowing up on the stairwell, clash, 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 and the actual windows blowing up as we go down. We lost our footing and everything. And I remember I told the guy, don't worry, after this, we're going to go for a beer. And the guy was like, yeah, with his face. But, you know, I don't think anybody drank there. I mean, I didn't drink. And it was just like something that you said to continue the motivation. And as we went down, the areas, the walls of some of the escalators, you could see right through from the stairwell level, and you could see the offices. That's another, you know, thing that we find out, that they built a building with a lot of violation, because that stairwell should have been enclosed in concrete, not sheetrock. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
Because an escape route. as I went down with this group, we made it to the lobby, and when we made it to the lobby, there's total disaster in the area. I mean, the South Tower already collapsed. Remember, I don't know when it collapsed because I have no idea because, right. You know, we have no windows. But there's dust, this huge amount of gray dust everywhere. And do you remember that beautiful marble that was on the lobby of the World Trade Center?
Right,
that was
sure.
totally pulled out from the walls. There was just, you know, the bare walls. We put the man on the wheelchair down. Three other firemen got close to us. One of them said, get the ambulance ready, get the ambulance ready. And when I looked to my left-hand side, the area where they have the mezzanine and the shopping center, that's all collapsed because, of course, the South Tower already collapsed. And when I look at the passenger elevators on the lobby, they were open basically like a pyramid from the bottom up, and you will see like this wedge from the bottom up, like an indication that something powerful came from the bottom, not from the top. Otherwise, it would have been the opposite wedge. And when I saw that, oh my God, what's going on? And I went towards the front of the building to prepare the ambulance, because that's what they told me, get the ambulance ready. As I went to the front, you know, bypass basically this whole area of destruction, because, you know, when I'm telling you this, I can remember that there was not a glass intact. All the glass on all the areas was shattered. And I get to the area of the revolving doors. And when I get to the front of the revolving doors, there's no revolving doors. You know, they were made of glass. There was, I guess, the sheer force of people trying to escape broke everything. And wow. But it was basically empty, just the frame. And I get there, and when I get there, what do I see? Across the street, almost a block and a half away, the area, what they called War Financial Center, they have the area cordoned now, and the police is there, and they saw me, and they start screaming, don't look back, don't look back, don't look back. And when they tell you don't look back, what are you going to do? You're going to look back.
You're going to look back, right.
Human condition.
Yeah.
Human condition. And that's when I turn around. Guys, and it was the worst thing I ever seen in my life, because when I turn around, I saw all the bodies of the people that jumped out of the building. There were body parts everywhere. And if I tell you that you couldn't recognize a single body part for the simple reason that the impact was so powerful, we're talking about, you know, the top floors, people jumping from the 86th floor and things like that. The impact was so powerful that it became just a body mass, a skin and clothing. That's the only thing you saw, and hair. But you couldn't recognize what was what. And when I saw that, I started screaming and crying, saying, oh my God, what is this? What is this? What is this? And when I looked down, what do I see? The only body that I could recognize, that I could pinpoint and say, yeah, that I know that person. It was the one from that lady on the 33rd floor. I saw that lady cut in half, found her cut in half in front of the building. And I speculated that she probably said, oh my God, I saved myself. Came out, and a glass from the top of the windows of the building came down and basically like a guillotine cut her.
Right.
Because, you know, there was glass everywhere. And I was like screaming, oh my God, oh my God, because this is too horrific. I mean, we're talking about a war scene. Mm-hmm. And I hear all of a sudden, run, run, run. And everybody across the street running away. And the only thing I see across the building, in front of the building, is a fire truck. And I just, you know, basically run onto the fire truck, you know. And when I put my leg in, my left leg in, the building started to collapse right on top of me. Bah! Bah! And the truck going down, down, down. Mm. And basically, I got totally engulfed there. And I remember I said, God, please don't give my mother the pain of seeing my body in pieces. Let her recognize my body, because I didn't want her to see what I just saw, unrecognizable body parts. And, you know, basically stay there. And all of a sudden, this huge cloud of dust came in. Remember that everybody running away from the building and that dust coming? Well,
of
it was
course.
Going under every orifice under the truck. And it burned my face. It burned my skin.
No.
And then all of a sudden, I said, now I'm not dead, squashed to death, but I'm going to die of asphyxia now. Right. And I couldn't breathe. I couldn't breathe. So I remember I was a magician for 30 years. So I used to do those escape acts. I used to escape from straitjackets and handcuffs and chains. And I knew that, you know, when you're in trouble, I was taught that you have to relax. You have to lower your breathing. You have to concentrate and wait for help. In my case, I was waiting for death. Luckily, across the street, there were two television stations who said, you know, the last man to come out was on that area, and they pointed the area, and that's how they started the whole rescue effort. And hours after, I was pulled from under the rubble and basically received oxygen in the area on an ambulance that was on the perimeter. And once I recovered 15 minutes after, I ran back. I ran back to the truck to find out if there was anybody there. And guess what? When they removed the truck, if they have waited 5 extra minutes, I wouldn't be here because the tires blew up when they removed the truck.
Wow, so, my God.
You know, it's just, you know, at the nick of time. And I was there for several hours. So, you know, here you have the whole event, how basically it changed my life. It just, you know, I realized that, you know, once I saw the whole thing, the whole collapse, I just couldn't believe it. Really, it was totally unbelievable. And there was a bridge that connected the North Tower with the World Financial Center. Right. And we went under, and we would look for people that were alive. And I remember that there was a fire truck, and I look under a fire truck, and I see two fireman boots, and I pulled the boots, and when I look inside, there was the leg of the fireman in there, and I started screaming, and that's when you realize that, you know, this was like a huge loss of life, and it hits you bad. Right. It was total disaster. It was an apocalyptic view of the end of the world for me. Right. I mean, it was just that bad, and I just couldn't understand, you know, there was 110 floors on each building. 16 acres building. Where did everything go? Everything just collapsed to a rubble of 6 floors.
And what was the sound? What was the sound like when the collapse is taking place?
You know, the sound is very, very distinctive. I will never forget that sound ever. Is, you know, when you are on, if you're in New York, when you're under a subway, that taka 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 sound.
Yeah.
Just that exact sound multiplied by thousands of decibels, da, 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 exactly the same way, as fast. And it just like that loud, it just, you know, it stays with you forever.
Wow.
Okay, I want to move into a couple of member questions, or we're going to get the living crap beat out of us by the membership. First off, I got to tell you that, boy, we got just literally hundreds and hundreds of UTUs and private email messages with just nothing but accolades and thanking you for everything that you've done.
God bless
done
everybody. No,
yeah,
God
you've,
bless everybody.
You've got a huge, you have a real huge support network here on AboveTopSecret.com. And it's just like you and I have always talked. You know, I mean, there's always going to be a couple of people, you know, that, you know, have different opinions, and that's fine. You know, it's America. God love it. You know, everybody has a right to their own opinion and their own attitude. And pretty much when I'm scrolling down and looking at the thread, a lot of the things that you have already talked about have already been addressed. But here's one by a member that asked about the RICO case.
RICO lawsuit with a lawyer called Phil Berg, thinking that they, you know, actually every time that we did a lawsuit, I'm talking about the family, survivors, and those affected by the event, has been to gather information. And remember that in the beginning, the government did not want a formal investigation about what happened on 9/11. You know, the administration put every obstacle so we wouldn't have that. And I was like, oh, my God, you know, here's the death of 3,000 people, over 3,000 people. And, you know, let me clarify that. We don't know. A lot of people don't ask this, but I will ask it and answer it. We don't know the actual amount of people that died because of 9/11. Why? Because they did not take in consideration all the illegal immigrant workers that were in the building. Think about it.
Yeah.
You know, how many people were working there with undocumented, with fake papers, and because of the fake papers, the people will appear alive somewhere else because it was a false identity, they were not counted on the death group. I mean, Group Tepeyac, which is a Mexican group, identify 106 people themselves. So, you know, don't follow the official story in terms of how many people die there, because I honestly don't know how many, were not counted.
Yeah, and hang on one second, because for the people that don't know what the RICO lawsuit is, just give me a real snippet.
The RICO lawsuit, the RICO lawsuit is the one, the law that was created in the late 60s to go and attack the mafia. The only effective tool that they have to fight the mafia after the 60s was the RICO statute, which was criminal enterprising and things like that. And we found
so basically racketeering.
Racketeering, exactly. And of course, it has a lot of different articles of law that can be applied for, you know, getting information and things like that. The Contail Pro program and things like that. And we wanted to get information, and, you know, this guy approached me, and yes, you know, I'll do it. I'll lend my name for it. And this is when I'm getting invitations all over the world, and I'm going all over the world and doing this kind of presentations. And basically, the lawsuit went on federal court, and it mentions close to over 50 people in the government that will have information related to 911 that we wanted to get information from. And I sued the president directly. I sued Bush. And, I get a lot of calls about that. Are you still suing George Bush? No. I got out from the RICO lawsuit because I noticed that the problem with the lawsuit was that the lawyer, Phil Berg, put all these kind of conspiracy theories that I honestly didn't read when I signed for it.
Right.
Because I'm traveling and stuff like that. And, you know, they give you a basically a book of almost 260 pages here. This is the lawsuit. I said, whoa, you know, okay, no, whatever. Then I find out that he put every single conspiracy theory there. And actually, I've been paying for that ever since. I realized that this is not going anywhere. And I removed myself, fired the lawyer, and removed myself from it. And basically, the case was still going. But because I removed myself, they give you a time where you can do a motion. They did motion to dismiss constantly.
Right.
And I will refile and things like that.
Okay, so that was basically basically their question. If you plan, if you guys plan on refiling your lawsuit?
No. I'm not getting involved with that lawyer.
You're out of the RICO business altogether, then?
Oh, definitely, altogether.
So basically, if I'm understanding this correctly, and William, please correct me if I'm misunderstanding this, and that's why I want to be sure. Basically, people approached you and said, hey, we'd like you to do this, yada, yada. They knew who you were, the fact that you were a hero of 9/11, all this other stuff. And you go, sure, yeah, you know, if it helps the people, it helps the survivors, and helps whatever.
Correct.
You get sucked into this deal, and then all of a sudden you find out that it's just more than a restitution or whatever, or this or that, or find the responsible party. You find out that all these other sub-agendas are attached to it, and that's when you said, hey, I'm out of here. Is that pretty much it?
That is 100% correct.
Okay. All right. John, you got a question? I know you do.
Oh, absolutely. When you were in the volunteer stage mode, obviously the towers have collapsed already, and you are still offering assistance in whatever position you can, did you happen to see anything around where all the destruction was that might have included, like, possibly airplane parts being scattered around? Was there anything identifiable
You couldn't find parts like that, because everything was debris, pulverized concrete, steel. There were some of the buildings were on fire, meaning the U.S. Custom building, building 5 was on fire. So, you know, the thing that you realize at that moment is just you're trying to look for people that are alive.
Survivors,
yeah. And remember, I also was there the following day with something called the Bucket Brigade, which was they gave us buckets to basically dig with our hands to look for people. And these fine pieces here and there, I did have a friend that is in Florida who got a piece of the plane that actually probably wasn't part of the investigation. We got a piece of like the bottom of the seat of the plane.
Okay.
And I was like, whoa, yeah. So
okay.
It could be connected, Johnny.
Sure. I just wanted to add that.
Come up with stories. Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. Well, we've got a number of members that have asked a bunch of questions, and that was one of the questions they had asked. Obviously, there are a lot of questions that our members have submitted here at AboveTopSecret.com to ask you, William, but Dave and I are not going to have the chance to ask them because of, not only because of time constraints, but also because you've already covered those answers in what you told us in regards to your personal event there at the World Trade Center. So, Dave, go right ahead, sir.
But there's one or two here that I think out of your masterful story, and I mean, I William, I gotta tell you, you know, I mean, I was working out at some.
Where were you when this happened?
I'll tell you exactly where I was. I was at a place called Bally's. They also call it President's now. It was a, you know, one of these workout things where you go for the primary reason of seeing all the chicks in the thong underwear.
Okay.
you'll walk around it, whatever. But I was there. I was on a treadmill. I looked up. I saw when I saw the first tower hit. And that was when they were reporting on CNN that it was strictly some, you know, like a private little plane, like a, you know, Cessna or some kind of thing. And, you know, I'm on the treadmill and I'm looking up and, you know, at this stage, CNN has not said unequivocally that it was a commercial airliner. Uh-huh. And then all of a sudden, we're watching the screen, and we see the second plane come in and hit the other tower. And that's when I knew that we were being attacked. And I cannot tell you, of course, you were there, so I guess I can tell you. I got sick. I literally got sick to my stomach. I was so blown away by it. It just really, really, really devastated me. So anyway,
he asked both of us. So let me just say that I was I was sound asleep, and I had my boss that I was working for at that time call me up, and I believe that was probably about 4:45, 5 o'clock in the morning when he called me up, and he only said, "Turn on your TV." I turned on the TV, and then, of course, every station had the event on, and so that's how I was brought into. Knowing
yeah, because you know, guys, this the reason that I ask is because this is a question that I ask everywhere that I go, all over the world, and because you know, I always say that 9/11 has been the catalytic event that changed the whole new millennium, because everything is measured now before 9/11, after 9/11, and you have seen how we have been basically our lives, everybody's life, have been changed because of the event. And, you know, how they have used our tragedy for a political agenda constantly. And so we have to deal with that constantly, not only as survivors and people affected by the event, but because we never had a proper grieving process, because everything, we were bombarded from the very beginning by the media. So it was crazy for us.
Okay, let's move on to some more questions. In fact, we got segued into talking about a sidebar, William. You did a great sidebar there. I love that. You must be going to the Dave Rabbit School of Sidebars. Okay, this member asked that he wants to know what your feelings have been, or when people take what you say, and, you know, as I said earlier, you know, there's always going to be some knucklehead out there that, you know, wants to take it in a different direction. But when this smear campaign, you know, trying to discredit you and this, that, and the other stuff, how did it affect you? I mean, here you put your life on the line, basically, a hero in my book any day of the week. You go up, you make three more trips into the thing. I mean, you see death and destruction around you. How does it make you feel when someone says, and I'm not going to go quote, but when someone makes derogatory comments about you, William?
Well, you know, let me put it this way. It's just the uninformed information that they don't get. People attack me, but they don't even follow the whole investigation of everything that I've done after 9/11. After 9/11, I became the president of the Hispanic Victims Group. I was involved with the 9/11 United Services Group. I put benefits out there for the victims constantly. You can ask any family or survivor out there, and they will tell you of all the programs that I work for them. I raised millions of dollars for the victims, and I found myself homeless, living under a bridge, because they didn't give me a hand, because they thought, okay, this guy has helped so many people, he can help himself. And it was not the case. And, you know, when I see these kind of things, that they don't even know all the work that I have done, all the stuff that I have done for victims, not only of 9/11, but other issues, other catastrophe as well, because I helped the victims of the Madrid bombing, the Himani flooding, where 2,500 people died in the Dominican Republic, things like that. They don't see that. They don't put that information out there. They just want to attack. You know why? For the simple reason that they did not agree from the very beginning that I went against the government official story that, you know, about the explosions. You know, this is my experience. I lived through that. I experienced it. And, you know, why would I change what I was experiencing that day just to make anybody happy? I can't. You know, I may have been wrong maybe on knowing what the explosions are. It could be. But there were explosions there. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
And
sure.
Why would I change? What I will keep quiet about that. People attack me that I didn't say that on television in the beginning. I say something else. Listen, we have here over an hour and a half where you gave me the opportunity to go on almost every single detail. On television, they'll tell you, you have 30 seconds to go on the air and say your piece. 30 seconds.
Right.
And 30 seconds, you cannot do that. Impossible. What I gave you here, you cannot put it on a nutshell. It's impossible. So because they didn't hear that, oh, you changed your story. Oh, you said this, but you didn't say that. Say, hello.
Right.
You know, realize that we don't have time
for that. Chapter, you're giving them another chapter in the time that they've allowed you instead of hearing the whole story.
Correct. Exactly. Correct. Correct. I guess they didn't like the case that we pushed so hard for an investigation. And sadly, remember, and I want to make this point clear for everybody to understand all around the world, because I know this is heard all around the world,
yes,
that they spent more money on the Monica Lewinsky trial than they did on the death of 3,000 people. And that's immoral anywhere in the world. It was more important
terrible.
for Americans to find out what Monica was doing under a desk. $40 million.
Right.
They spent on the Monica Lewinsky thing.
Well, I find that stupidity. I mean, I find that sheer stupid.
Right.
Thank you.
Well, William, and I appreciate the answers that you just gave, Dave. And going to the other side of the spectrum, we have another member who would rather take a positive route, which is he wants to know, or she, what can he or she do to help you, William Rodriguez, because they support you fully and they want to make sure that they can help lend you any type of support that they can. So what could a person do to help you out, William?
Yeah, the only way, and remember, I don't get a salary for this. I'm actually make less money now than I did when I was a janitor. You see, I was even obligated. A lot of people, and that's a question that probably you don't have there, but I will answer it anyway, which is like, you know, some people have come out and said, you're exploiting 9/11. Say, hello, I'm the person that was there, and I get accused because I say I am 9/11. Listen, I live 9/11 more than anybody else, in the sense that I live it 24 hours a day, more than anybody else in a derogatory way. But, you know, I have to do this constantly. And the reason that I talk about this is for one single point. A lot of people have said, you know, you're exploiting this. Well, when you have Major Giuliani, that has gone around the world and made $107 million, Giuliani and partners, by exploiting our tragedy, you know, is kind of an offensive thing to say to me. And when I was homeless living under a bridge, I live on a basement. You know, people see this website, me talking to the top ministers and president of all these countries, and they don't know that that is the same suit that you have seen on every picture. I have been going around with the same suit for the last 5 years, 6 years, that I live on a basement with a broken bathroom and no kitchen. And the only way that I do this is through donations. Donations, and by selling a DVD that I didn't even have a couple of years ago. And I have to basically take the story, put it on a DVD to survive. And, you know, people can go to william911.com, order the DVD, and we have The Last Man Out coming out this week. That is going to be basically the whole story when I went through this tour in Europe, and they followed me with cameras, and we made this new video called Last Man Out. That's going to be out next week. But meanwhile, they can order the What Really Happened on 9/11, which is what I've been supporting myself basically with, and going around these countries to try to expand the information and pinpoint all the issues. You know, one of the issues that we haven't talked about is the first responders. You know, you have 160 first responders, close to 160 that have died because they, you know, got that toxic dust in their system. All the dogs basically died. All the rescue dogs basically died. And what you have is over 60,000 people in New York sick because of the environmental effect that it created. And the government knew about it and, you know, basically didn't protect us correctly.
You just mentioned about the air quality. There was a deal that I happened to read where the EPA had said, and I believe this was just within 2 days after the collapse of the towers, that the air was safe to breathe. And then it was later discovered, of course, that this was not true at all because the intense heat,
that's incorrect. It wasn't within 2 days. It was several weeks after. But the reality was that the EPA, the government agency that had the jurisdiction of the environmental impact in the area, basically gave nothing, what is called top protective gear, to the firemen. They gave them paper dust masks. When you see the pictures of the Pentagon and the cleanup on the Pentagon, they have something called hazmat protective gear, which is, and David will explain to you, is this uniform that they use in the military that is from head to toe. You have protection and this huge filter mask on the side. They didn't have that at the World Trade Center. So, you know, these people, you see the pictures, and they are on T-shirts with no protection whatsoever. Now, on top of that, you know, I did an interview, which I will make available in the future, with Dr. Doc Rocky, who is the father of the depleted uranium program. And on top of that, a person that had the unit that was in charge of what they call environmental catastrophe in United States, military unit. And he called, he says that on video, he calls directly to the EPA to tell them that the area has to be contained, that, you know, the stuff that they needed to do. And they told him to shut up and to go away. And this is a top military expert.
Wow.
Disaster management. And so, you know, we have that video to prove that. And we have sued the EPA. We had, and let me make clear, because a lot of people think that we're suing for money. We never sued for money, not a single time. We have been suing from the very beginning for information, to make this information available. And when you have the situation that happened just yesterday, that the CIA have erased tapes of tortures, you know, what does that tell you about what other information may have been gone or disappeared about 9/11 that we don't know about? So we need to worry.
Yeah,
what we have here is just pushing, and of course I get attack, and basically you have people attacking me constantly. I don't care. Let them do it. As long as they don't touch my survivors, victims, and families, I'm okay. I'll suck it up. You know what I'm saying? But, at the moment that they go and start attacking the family members, then we have a problem.
Yeah, and, you know, you and I talked about that in some of our personal conversations, too. And I think, Johnny and I have a couple of personal questions before we let you go pick your wife up. But, I want to commend the AboveTopSecret.com membership because they really came through. They really did a masterful job of asking some specific questions and not going into what Johnny and I like to call the dark side, which I'm capable of going to myself many times. So anyway, I want to thank the AboveTopSecret.com membership. Now we want to go into a couple of personal questions before we let you go.
Sure.
I guess maybe it's because of my own background in Vietnam, and you've done some masterful little comparisons there along the way of how it was to 9/11 or any war for that matter, whether it's Iraq or whatever, being in harm's way. But, you know, I got to ask you this, William, and I mean, I know my own answer.
Let's clarify something, David.
Okay,
for the audience out there.
Sure.
You have not given me any question prior to this. I have no idea.
No, you don't. No. Yeah. I know. I see where we're going with this one. Yeah, conspiracy theory again. No.
Yeah.
This is a question that I have that William was not made aware of. He was not made aware of any questions whatsoever. So let's clarify that. So now, here's my question. You know, I know what it takes. Not that I am anywhere near the shape, form, fashion of where you are as far as the quote hero. I'm not. But I have seen people in battle. I have seen people lose their lives. And I know the gut feel that you have when you're experiencing this. But, William, I got to ask you. I mean, I would love to have asked some firemen and some policemen up there. You know, it was their job to go in and save people, okay? But you are a... And I'm not trying to make this light. You were a janitor of a building, yet you chose, as opposed to finding your own safety, seeking someplace safe, you chose, not anybody twisting your arm or beating you on the head, but you chose to go back in that building and help your fellow man. How, I mean, what did it take that, I mean, did you even think about it at all, or was it just natural instinct?
I have an answer for that. Compassion is the word. Compassion. Knowing that I have the unique item, which was a master key at that moment, that I could help so many people. When, you know, you have violence doesn't last as long as compassion. You know, it takes more effort and lasts longer to be angry than to be happy and to be compassionate. It really does. And I tell you, it just when it came to that moment, you are trying to do the most amount of thing in the least amount of time. Yes, I was a janitor. Yes, but I survived the bomb of 93, and I saw all the errors and mistakes that happened during the bomb of 93. So I didn't want to commit the same mistakes as other people did. So I said, and remember, this is chop talk that we had within the workers there, that we expected something to happen in this building all these years. We didn't know what.
Right.
We knew that, you know, the work was not finished when they had the bomb of 93. So right. We expected something. But I said from the very beginning that, you know, I was going to try to do whatever it took, because I saw, and especially when I was on that basement, when I saw the total disorientation, nobody knew what to do. Somebody had to take charge. Why did I take charge? Desperation. I was desperate to try to get them out, and to try to basically, when I get outside, I realize that my friends on the top are stalking there. So that motivated me to sacrifice myself. And guess what? Would I do it again? 100 times.
Yeah.
If that meant so that I will die, I will do it 100 times.
Right.
I have one final question, and then we have to wrap things up here, William. And again, thank you so much for your time and inconvenience
in
doing
this. I really appreciate what you've done.
My final question is this. The 9/11 Commission interviewed you in a closed session at
yes.
the FEMA office in New York City, but none of that testimony that you gave has been included in the Commission's report. How do you feel about that, and why do you think it wasn't included?
You're right. I testified behind closed doors. I used to say that, you know, I was the only, not the only person. What I meant to say was that one of the VIPs, remember, these people took me to the White House. They wanted me to be their minion. They wanted me to run for political office. They saw me as the Trump card to get the Hispanic Latino vote, and I mean 30 million voters. So they were basically whining and dining me. And once I start asking for the 9/11 commission, all the support disappeared. And once we get the commission, I have to testify behind closed doors. While I was considered a VIP by them before, all the time I was not the only one. There were over 1,000 people that testified behind closed doors. But my testimony was a key factor, because I provided them with people, close to 27 people that were on the basement that were never called to testify, ever, never called to testify. And why wasn't that included? Because it blows away the official story in a way, because, you know, they're saying that the building collapsed by the planes. Maybe it did. Let's say it did. But when you do an investigation, and this is a CSI simple logical thing to follow through, when you do an investigation, a criminal investigation anywhere in the world, as the magnitude as the World Trade Center, which was the biggest crime scene we ever had,
right.
You have to check every allegation. You need to check every angle. Everybody knows that. The commission did not do that. And that's where we had the problem. And when they took my information, they didn't add it there. They didn't call these people that we put to testify. We knew that something was wrong. And that's when I started speaking out loudly, because before the 9/11 Commission, I was so busy with the crime victims' issues.
Right.
The programs and the benefits and the issues of the families. And then I realized, whoa, what's going on here? So we felt that they failed us. And 6 years after 9/11, we're still searching for answers.
I'm just curious. I mean, you know, we've talked about so many things in this wonderful interview that we've done. But are there any obstacles that have come your way as a result of your participation in all this media circus of the 9/11 and your actions as being a hero of 9/11?
I believe I've been blacklisted many, many ways. And one of the things also that comes to surface is that, you know, here I am recognized as basically a VIP for the victims of 9/11. And they put me on the no-fly list. And that's
what? Wait. They put you on a what? On the no-fly list?
I am on the no-fly list. When I go to fly, my name pops up on the computer. They always put me on the side. They have to ask me questions. It's just crazy. Yeah. Every time.
Wait a minute. Now I got.
I don't understand
that. I don't know if I. I don't want to do a rant, but you're telling me that a hero of 9/11 is on a no-fly list along with the suspected people that they might be terrorists. You're telling me that a hero of the United States of Puerto Rican descent has been here since he's 20 years old is on a stinking no-fly list, and that you get treated like a common criminal?
Yeah, that's 100% right, and it happens all the time. And you can verify it. Just call Homeland Security and get the information directly from them. But it's true. Every time I fly, and I ask, he said, why you? I remember the first two times that I got stopped, I said, what's going on? And they said, well, you're on the no-fly list. And that's, you know, your name pops up on the computer. And I was like, whoa, okay. And it's all the time a hassle. You know, they have to ask you questions. They, you know, since I have no criminal record or anything like that, they will ask you where you're going, who's paying for your trip. What? And it's usually the same people, because I always travel from New York or New Jersey. And
right.
I know most of the Homeland Security people. They're, oh, it's Rodriguez again. They see me as Willie because I'm always traveling. So they always go through this process. So, you know, it's just something that I have to live with, but it's unacceptable. It really is.
Do the tactics ever change in the way they ask their questions, or do they just ask the same questions over and over each time?
Same questions each time, yeah.
That's ridiculous.
And I said, yeah, well, you guys know exactly what I'm going to be talking about. I said, well, Willie. They even call me Willie. Willie, you know we have to ask this, and this is a proper procedure. So I said, okay, no problem.
Jesus.
That's crazy.
Yeah, but, it's crazy. That's one of the many things that happens. And but, you know, you take it stride. You take it stride.
You know, and this is just one last thing.
Information is too powerful. Remember this. Yeah. And there's a lot of people that are very nervous with this kind of information.
Well, and you know, to me, I got to be honest with you on this. You know, you're telling me this, and I got tears in my eyes. And I want to tell you why. What kind of country do we live in that we treat our heroes like this? I don't understand it.
It's not easy. It really is not. But, you know, we have to motivate ourselves, and you as a survivor, because you're a survivor of the Vietnam War, you understand this better than anybody because of the way you were treated afterwards. And you see, you know, we realize that we don't do this for anybody in the sense of, I'll tell you a story. I used to work, and this is an allegory. I used to work on the office of the governor of New York, and Governor Cuomo used to say, I used to go through Wall Street every single morning, and there was a lady always selling apples there. And I would go and put 50 cents for the apple, and I would never take an apple, and I would continue walking. I did that for 3 months, and on the third month, the lady starts screaming at me, Mister, Mister, Mister. And he turned around and said, I know why you are calling me. You are going to call, you are going to ask me why I put 50 cents on your cup every day and I don't take an apple. And she said, no. What I wanted to tell you is that tomorrow the apples are $1. You know, we realize that they don't understand and they don't appreciate sometimes the level of work or the level of exposure that we are doing to better the life of everybody around. They don't understand that. We understand it because it becomes a mission. We become addicted, and that's a word, addicted to help. And we don't do it for any other reason but just to feel better for our loss. And we had such a terrible loss. And, you know, resiliency in moments of difficulty comes from your spiritual standing. And my standing is very strong because I know that I'm doing the right thing. And I hope, even though this is going to be difficult and I'm going to be attacked, etc., that sometime in the future, maybe 10, 20 years from now, people will recognize the work that we did for bettering our lives. They're using 9/11 to eliminate our civil rights constantly. Now in the United States, they can hold you against your will. They can put you in jail basically without any a court order, without the right to a lawyer. They can tap your phone. They can open your emails. They have a thought crime that just is passing in Congress that basically anybody that question, you know, our involvement in the Iraq war or things like that, we can be deemed prosecutable. That's what we're living, and we are fighting. If we are fighting outside our country to better our lives, why are we getting so constrained with our rights here? It doesn't make sense. So we are trying to fight that.
Right. All right. Well, listen, I know that we're coming up 2 minutes till countdown. Before
we got 5 minutes more.
Well, we're going to close it at two. So, you know, I tell you, we could literally, and I know Johnny would agree with me, we could literally talk to you for hours, William, because not only are you just a super, super nice guy that I've just really have enjoyed our personal chats with, but you just have just a tremendous heart, and to me, that's what makes you very special to Dave Rabbit, and I feel Johnny would agree with me also.
Sure.
I want to tell you, William, that we want to we're probably, because of the absolute generous length of time that you've given us to tell everything in a very expanded version so that people know, you know, without having to get snippets here and there, they know exactly what happened that day. And you answered so many questions and those of our members. And I just can't thank you enough for reliving the experience again. I know you've done it many times, but I know that it doesn't get any easier when you see those visions in your brain. So I want to tell the
members. It does stay with you forever. It marks you.
Yeah.
Like I said, and for example, one of the reactions that I get, every time I go into an elevator on a tall building, I will hear the screams of the people because that's part of the post-traumatic shock disorder.
Wow. Right. Well, I want to remind everybody about your website, which tells about the events that you have going on and press clippings and, you know, your blog and some other things in there. And William's website, again, is, and we'll post a shortcut on this interview thread, and this will be a two-parter. I have been cued by the Johninator, but they'll both be up at the same time. It'll just say part one, part two. His website is www.william911.com. That's www.william911.com. And I just can't thank you enough, William, for giving Johnny and I this ability to have an in-depth conversation with you and your generosity of being involved in something that I think it has to have somebody that can say, you know, this is what happened that day. This is what I believe. You know, right, wrong, or indifferent, you know, you hold your ground and you have a friend here with Dave and Johnny, I can assure you.
Thank you so much. I want to say thank you publicly, and we'll leave the door open. We'll do more stuff later on, and I will supply you with more connections and victims if needed, and experts from other places. I think we can tell the audience that now on some of the trips that I will do, abroad on all these countries, I may bring some special reports for you.
Oh, that would be fantastic. We'd love to hear it. So please keep us in the loop. And on behalf of not just Dave and myself, but the entire Above Top Secret Network, and also for the world, thank you, William, for bringing this story to us and doing those heroic deeds that you did and continuing to move forward into trying to get the truth out into what happened. And I'd like to just do this in an area that I haven't had a chance to practice enough in, and that would be que es el mismo contigo. Tú es mi amigo. Tú es mi amigo nuevo en esta día. Y muchas gracias.
Oh, muy bien. Very good.
See, you think.
Now we can go order the chalupa from him.
Yeah. Where the hell was he at Taco Bell?
Yeah. So,
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave or Johnny at www.abovetopsecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat.